All right, my friends, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. I keep all the archives in MP3 format for you there. Also, let me mention real quickly that I'm a additional contributor to antiwar.com, although I haven't written anything for him in a couple of weeks. Maybe there's an article in this next interview. It's Rick Bloom. He's the director of OpenTheGovernment.org, which has just produced their second annual secrecy report card, Quantitative Indicators of Secrecy in the Federal Government. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Hi, Scott. Good to be here.
It's good to have you on, sir. How exactly do you quantify secrecy?
Well, it's tough to do. I mean, if you have things in a black box, all you can do is really see what's outside the box and measure its width and its depth and its height. And so you don't really get a sense of what's inside the box. And so what we tried to do is look at actual government data, government indicators of secrecy. They don't actually call it secrecy when they're putting out the data, but we tried to go from a variety of things, from the number of requests that the public makes under the Freedom of Information Act, all the way to the classification activity, how many times documents are stamped secret or top secret, things like that.
I guess it says in your report card here that you've seen, especially over the last couple of years, a tremendous increase in the amount of secrecy on the national level.
Across the board, if you're looking at state secrets, if you're looking at the number of meetings that are closed, either advisory committee meetings, to the number of patents that are ordered to be kept secret, we're seeing a broad expansion of secrecy in the federal government, which is, of course, runs counter to our open society and our expectations for a government that is for, by, and of the people.
Open society. I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, in our democracy, our Constitution says, you know, we are supposed to, when in doubt, we are supposed to be an open society. We're supposed to have the free flow of information. Uh-huh. And that includes government information. The government is the largest publisher of information in the United States. And so scientific knowledge, technical knowledge, advances in technology and science start many times with the government. And the government's obligations are to operate openly, to get advice when they're thinking about putting in a new environmental regulation, consider the views of industry, consider the views of environmental groups, and make decisions accordingly, reflecting those opinions. And what? More and more we're seeing those operations of government closed, behind closed doors, and that's problematic.
Can you tell me a little bit about your group, OpenTheGovernment.org? I notice from your website you have a long list of individual members, but you also sort of serve as an umbrella organization for other groups too, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's across the board, whether it's groups that work on whistleblower issues and the rights and protections for whistleblowers, to library groups, to environmental groups, to labor groups, they've all been impacted in one way or another by expanding and growing secrecy in the federal government. And as they became more and more concerned, they decided they needed to do something about it more than what they could do individually. And so a coalition was formed a couple years ago, and what we've been trying to do is to highlight secrecy and talk about it in ways that resonate, that makes sense, because oftentimes it's very hard to sort of cover these things. And the press, actually, is growing more and more concerned. And they've, for many years, seen it as sort of inside baseball, as a problem of their profession that they continually sort of struggle against in their newsroom. But perhaps maybe the public doesn't really get it or doesn't really depend on it. And now, more and more, they're actually seeing it as a public right and a public concern, and they're more and more vocal about it.
Oh, very good. All right. In fact, I think we'll start off with the media's role in all this when we get back. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with Rick Bloom from OpenTheGovernment.org.
Don't take your guns to town.
Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Rick Bloom. He's the director of OpenTheGovernment.org, which has just produced their second secrecy report card. And when we went out to the break, sir, you're talking a little bit about the media and how they used to just sort of see problems of government secrecy as sort of their own little problem because that's their job is reporting about stuff. And they didn't really see it as a problem for the American people. But you're saying that attitude is changing among members of the media.
Absolutely. They're becoming more vocal. And I think that they're understanding that the public really wants an active media corps, that they want the journalists to be asking questions. And in fact, they expect journalists to be asking questions, even in the past few weeks. With the disaster in New Orleans and in the entire Gulf Coast, you're seeing the media ask more and more tough questions. Where was the government? Why weren't they helping these poor folks? And why weren't they doing more? And I think that the expansion of secrecy over the last few years has, in a similar way, although over a longer period of time, has sort of woken up the media. That the public does depend on openness in government and that the public does want to participate in the decisions of government because the government has so much power. I'll just give you one quick example that I think that got a lot of attention. There was a man in Virginia who's a former Army Ranger, and he was concerned because he found out that there was a very large oil and gas pipeline that was going to run right through his community. So he went to try to find out which properties were going to be affected, whether his property was going to be affected or his neighbors, exactly where this thing was going to go. And this was a couple of years ago. And he was told, we can't give this to you, because if we give this to you, if we give you the map, then a terrorist might be able to figure out how they can do something. Well, he couldn't organize the community because the community didn't know where this oil and gas pipeline was going to go. Well, after all the permits were issued, guess what showed up in the local library? A map showing exactly which properties would be affected by this oil and gas pipeline. It's freely available to anyone in the public. So that raises the question, are we really trying to expand secrecy just for the security of the country, or are we trying to expand secrecy for the ease of government to get what they need?
Sure, and always hiding behind the excuse of terrorism, too.
It's a very easy, because we're all very concerned about terrorism, and it's something that it feels like it's something that we can't control very much. And so it's easy to say, look, we're afraid of terrorism, we don't want information to fall into the wrong hands. Well, what we're forgetting in that is that science and technology advances are built on sharing of information among scientists and a free flow of information among researchers. Now, sure, there's some information that you're not going to want to let out. I certainly don't want to know the security codes for the nuclear bombs. Of course that should be kept secret. We're not absolutists. We're not saying everything should be open and freely available to anyone. But there has to be some rationality to it and some limits and some controls so that you don't. Right now we have a bill in Congress that would allow any head of a port or harbor anywhere in the United States to declare anything secret about that port or harbor. It could be some embarrassing information about their lack of security. But a journalist could not get at this information if this bill became law, because the head of the port or harbor could just declare anything that they wanted secret. They could hide a lot of embarrassing scandals underneath that veil of secrecy.
Well, and that really cuts right to it, doesn't it? I mean, isn't most of the secrecy just about protecting criminals in government from us?
It's a lot of embarrassing information can be hidden under secrecy. And secrecy, in general, doesn't bring you a lot of accountability if you're working in government. And I think that's essentially what the public expects, is that when we're spending our taxpayer dollars, we want to make sure that they're going to good uses.
Now you say
it might not even be, you know, criminal activity. It might just be stupid, dumb activity that can be hidden. And so that's what's really troublesome about all these numbers that we present in our report, is that there really is, every time you make one decision to classify a document secret, and you're doing it unnecessarily, you're hiding more and more information, and that brings our government less and less accountable to the people.
You say in your secrecy report card that the government spent $7.2 billion just last year just in classifying the actual stuff that needs classifying.
Absolutely. And that includes, you know, a lot of the physical security buildings, the secure buildings, creating the passwords and the enormous software programs that are required to store and keep classified information. On the flip side, we spend about $300 million responding to public requests and public demands for information under the Freedom of Information Act. We're putting a lot more money into the classification system. Now, some of that, you know, we might be getting secrets on the cheap. You know, again, those nuclear bomb codes, it's on an average of $460 per decision to keep a secret. That's probably a pretty good deal for U.S. taxpayers. But when the head of the Pentagon, a unit that's in charge of responding to these public requests for documents, says that about half of the classification decisions that she sees, half of the classified information that she sees, doesn't need to be classified. In fact, should not be classified.
Now, who was it that said that at the DOD?
This was a woman by the name of Carol Hobbs, and she testified before Congress, before a congressional subcommittee, on this problem of overclassification. And her estimate was that about half of the classified information she sees really should not be classified.
Wow.
And others estimate that it could be much higher, even 90%, according to some experts. So we're wasting, not only are we wasting a lot of dollars, taxpayer dollars, but we're also not getting the right information into the right people's hands. The 9/11 Commission said the biggest thing that we could do differently to defend against terrorist attacks and to protect ourselves better is to share more information, to make sure more information gets onto more people's desks. So that is, when there is that little nugget, when there is that little dot, we can connect them and we can find more solutions to our problems, not just related to terrorism, but related to environmental protections or to land use planning, so that we are a better, safer, healthier society.
Yeah, it says in your report, $1 spent declassifying old material for every $148 spent classifying new stuff.
Yes, and let me put that in perspective. In the mid to late 90s, for every dollar we spent declassifying documents, for every dollar we spent taking old secrets and releasing them to the public, we spent about $15 to $20 creating and storing our secrets. So there is that kind of balance there, if that is the right balance. I don't know. Well, in 2003, for every dollar we spent releasing old secrets, we spent about $120. Creating and storing new secrets. We're spending a lot more. And then in 2004, we spent $148 for every dollar we spent releasing old secrets. So we're taking money out of the class, out of the declassification system. We're spending fewer dollars on the declassification system. And we're spending a lot more creating and storing new secrets. So we're really shifting. And if there was a balance in the mid to late 90s, there sure is not a balance today.
One thing that's really interesting to me, there's a author named Robert Stinnett. He's the author of the book Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And the book is based on tons of declassified documents that, you know, they finally let him have 60 years after the fact. And when I interviewed Mr. Stinnett, he told me that he had stumbled across information about the railways to the death camps in Germany were on the do not bomb no matter what list. And I said, what? How could that possibly be? Why? And he said, you know, I don't know why. And the reason I don't know why is because the information that I was digging into and finding out about all this stuff, I had found out just enough that it had happened, but I didn't know why yet. And when I went back to get more documents to find out why, it turns out that all the stuff he'd been studying since about, you know, 60-year-old information was reclassified under the Patriot Act.
Sure. And right now, it's very hard to even know the overall intelligence budget. How much money does the U.S. federal government spend on intelligence activities? Just what's the single number? We don't know that. We know that for 1 year in the last 50 years.
Yeah, Congress probably doesn't even know the answer to that, do they?
Congress, it's hard to know that. We've never asked a member of Congress whether they know the overall intelligence budget figure. And the CIA has been closely guarding that secret. There's been a lawsuit that's been going on for years, trying to just find out how much, one figure, not how much are you spending on this program or that program or on a satellite program, but just how much money overall do U.S. taxpayers pay for our intelligence activity? And we just can't find that out.
They say that this is the most secretive administration ever. Do you find that to be the case?
Well, we don't try to solve the problem or question of, is this the most secretive administration ever? I heard some academics say this was the third most secretive administration behind our time in our history, behind the Civil War and behind World War One. I don't know, and I've heard John Dean say that this administration is worse than Watergate. I can't tell you that. What I can tell you is that it goes beyond any administration. I mean, this is not a partisan issue by any means. There is secrecy that's unnecessary in the courts. There's secrecy that's unnecessary in Congress. And what we want to do is send this bipartisan, nonpartisan message that the public really wants accountability. Whether you're conservative, whether you're liberal, we want an effective government that is accountable to the public. And this really cuts across.
All right, got to hold it right there. Got to hold it right there. I want an ineffective government that is accountable to the public. All right, we'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Did I say ineffective? I meant ineffective. I want the government to be ineffective. But yes, sir, we do agree, Mr. Bloom, that accountability is all important. And you can't have accountability in your government, the government that is supposedly made up of we the people. You can't have accountability when you have unlimited amounts of secrecy, can you?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think we probably do agree that we want an effective government. Now, some of us may think we don't want government to be doing certain things, and others will say, no, we want government to be doing things. But whatever it does, we want it to be effective, because we certainly want our taxpayer dollars to be used wisely. I also think that this problem, you asked about whether this was the most secretive administration. I think it's also very clear that part of the problem with secrecy in government is that so few people actually understand it, and we can't get our hands around this black box or this big elephant, whatever the right metaphor is. I think that you want to pat your local newspaper on the back, or at least the Texas newspapers on the back. Rich Oppold, who's the editor at the Austin American Statesman, actually introduced President Bush last year at a conference of newspaper editors, and in introducing him, he raised this problem. He said, look, we're spending billions and billions of dollars on classification systems, and yet we're not doing very much to help average members of the public to get information when they actually understand the Freedom of Information Act. They know that they have a right to get documents that are held by government, and they use them. That system just isn't really working very well.
Well, but don't you read Bob Woodward? Don't you know Bush doesn't owe anybody any explanations for anything?
Well, I think that anybody who sits in the Oval Office does owe a certain degree of explanation to the American public.
Yeah, the accountability moment is past, Rick.
There is never an accountability moment that's past. Every moment is an accountability moment.
All right.
And, I think President Bush, just to finish the thought here, President Bush seemed very surprised that we were spending so much money, even just on the classification system. I think that there's a lot of education that we need to be doing. As part of our report, we put together as many designations or categories or names that the government uses, our federal government uses, to restrict and limit the public's ability to get unclassified information. This isn't the top secret or confidential stuff where we stamp it, confidential, please don't give this to the public. This is unclassified public information. And we found at least 50 different ways or different names that the government puts on information that it does not want the public to get, that is not classified, that does not qualify to be classified. And a lot of it is duplicative, they're repetitive, some refer to others. And I think what this shows, this exercise shows very clearly, is that some agencies do things and some other agencies do things, but they don't all talk to one another, and there is no real coordinated system for deciding when an open society really needs to keep some secret. And I think that when we go through that process, or if we force government officials to go through that process, we would get a much more streamlined, narrow set of a secrecy system that is much more consistent with an open society than we have today. So this comes back to education and understanding what the problem is.
So basically, these 50 different categories that you found of, you call them sensitive but unclassified secrets, these are basically just ad hoc. Executive agency just makes up a designation and sticks all these in those in that folder.
Well, it really varies. Some of these are laws that Congress passes, like the Computer Security Act. Some of these are formal rules that agencies have put forward, like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission now has this new thing called safeguards information. And what they're basically saying is, we don't want to tell anybody what our security tests have shown and what other information have shown, because we don't want the public to know about any weaknesses in what we're doing. And we don't want to hear from the public about how we can strengthen the system. And we've had nonprofit groups actually write letters to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission saying, look, we understand you're doing this. We've talked to security guards. You have weaknesses. You're letting your guards know ahead of time that there's going to be these tests of the security around the nuclear plant. That's wrong. You shouldn't tell them. You got to do the test. So you can give them a real-life situation. There are problems, so let's try to fix them. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reacted by saying, all right, we're going to create this safeguards information category. And so we don't have to tell these nonprofits and the public about problems, or we don't even have to admit to them. So some of these are laws that Congress passes. Some of these are rules that executive agencies put together themselves. And some of these are just ad hoc things that they just are putting out there, writing memos saying, look, we have to control unclassified information. So we have this designation called controlled unclassified information. And it might just be a summary of all the laws. So it really, really does vary. And what there really is, there's no authority, there's no criteria for restricting or controlling information that goes beyond the classified system that's logical.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Rick Bloom. He's the director of OpenTheGovernment.org. They've just produced their second annual secrecy report card, Quantitative Indicators of Secrecy in the Federal Government, and we'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. Website is weekendinterviewshow.com, and I'm talking with Rick Bloom. He's the director of OpenTheGovernment.org. We're talking about their second annual secrecy report card that they've issued on the national government. And actually, Rick, you talk about the state governments a bit in there as well, and state-level secrecy, right?
Absolutely. I think that whatever happens at the federal level in Washington oftentimes is tucked up at the state level, or even vice versa. What's happening at the state level will influence what happens in Washington. And with this area, it's no different. And at the state level, folks who care about openness in their society really aren't doing as well. We saw almost twice as many secrecy laws passed as there were laws that expanded in some way openness in government. And that's a real troubling a testament to really where we are today. And, I'm really hoping that that as we move further and further away from the events of 9/11, and we're seeing other things happen, that we're understanding that we cannot be so focused on terrorism that we are taking away from our public safety and protections in so many other areas.
I want to talk to Scott Henson from the Texas ACLU, who I guess basically is his job to keep track of this kind of thing on the Texas level for that organization. And he told me that really here in Texas, we got pretty lucky because our legislature is only allowed to meet every 2 years. And they had just finished their session when September 11th happened. So it was 2 years or so before they could come back into session and pass a bunch of laws. Whereas I think he said in Florida, they had actually, their state legislature had just come to session when September 11th happened, and they passed a million laws, and most of them regarding how to lock up secrets of their state government.
Absolutely, and it's very hard for a legislator, be they in Congress or be they in the Texas legislature, the Florida legislature, you know, and right after the attacks, or right after something like 9/11, you know, what we all want to do is come together and see what needs to change and make changes and make them quickly and band together and fight the terrorists. We all want that. Unfortunately, that's a bad time and a bad way to be making law because we don't spend enough time looking at what we're actually passing. And that's what happened with the Patriot Act. And I think that right now you're seeing this debate about whether or not the tools of the Patriot Act are appropriate or excessive, and what kind of controls should be put on them in Congress in the very next few weeks. Congress will be sort of compromising and deciding between the House and Senate on very different visions for what the Patriot Act should allow government to do.
Well, and it was just a few weeks ago that they actually made it permanent, took out all the sunset provisions.
That there's a bill passed in the House and a bill passed in the Senate, and they do very, very different things. And now what they have to do is try to reconcile those differences. So the Patriot Act is not a story that's been written in the stone by any means. Congress, the House, and the Senate both have to get together and agree on one sort of version for extending or not extending the sunset. And if they don't act, then the most controversial provisions of the Patriot Act will actually die at the end of the year.
Oh, wow. So the conference committee isn't done yet.
It is absolutely not done. They are supposed to meet on September 16th and try to hammer out their differences. So if anybody cares about about that debate,
it's not over yet.
So there is plenty of discussion time available. I think another thing. It's not just about the Patriot Act. There are some good things that are happening. Your Senator John Cornyn.
Senator John Cornyn did something good. Come on, Rick, you're pulling my leg.
He's put a lot of energy into pulling people together to think about, well, how can we help the public get information from government, and how can we help make government more accountable? And so he's been focusing in on this Freedom of Information Act, which allows anybody to say, look, I know that the government has a document related to X, Y, or Z, so I'm going to make a request to the government to get a copy of that. That's the basic idea of it, that you have a right to any document that the government holds. It doesn't really work very well. There's a man who filed a Freedom of Information Act request when he was a graduate student. He was a tenured professor before he actually got his request fulfilled. That was a very, very, it took a long time.
Well, you said in your report card that, was it 85 or 90% of the agencies are behind on their FOIA requests?
Absolutely, and part of the problem is that they don't have enough resources to do the job right, and it's not a priority for agencies to fulfill these requests. So it's an inefficient system, but it's a backstop guarantee that the public has a right to information.
So does that mean that if you sue under FOIA, then the burden is on them to explain why not to release the document? Is that how that's set up?
Yes, and the law says that there are 9 general reasons that an agency can give to deny a FOIA request. You know, it might be that you're asking for sort of something that would affect the national security if it was released, or you're asking, I can't get Scott your Social Security number on a document. I can't get your tax records because those are private. That's your private information. It's things like that. Just getting back to your Senator John Cornyn for a second, he's put in a lot of energy to put together a bill and he's gotten bipartisan support for this bill that would make it a lot easier to get requests. It would give you a tracking number. If you put in a FOIA request, you get a tracking number so that you can check on the status of your request online. This is not novel stuff.
Chalk it up to my mistrust of John Cornyn, but are you sure there's not something buried in that bill that actually makes it a lot harder? I mean, that's how they do things here in Texas. If you vote yes, you really voted no, or if you vote no, you really voted yes, that kind of thing.
Well, as an attorney general in Texas, when he was your attorney general, he really wanted to make sure that government was more accountable. And so fortunately for you all, you have a much stronger freedom of information law in Texas than the country does with their Federal Freedom of Information Act. And it actually has penalties if government officials don't turn over the documents to citizens, or actually to the public. You don't even have to be a citizen. Well, on the federal level, we don't have that. There's no consequence for not turning over a document. So if you're sitting there in your government cubicle, and you know you'll be fired if you don't classify this document and keep it secret, or you'll be fired if you release a document that you shouldn't, or what are the consequences if I release a document if I withhold a document that I shouldn't have? Well, there's no consequences for withholding something that I really should turn over to the public. So what am I going to do? I'm going to keep my job, and I'm just going to withhold this, or I'll classify it, and I'm going to err on the side of caution so I can keep my job.
Sure.
That's the system that's in place. So we need to change these incentive structures to make sure that folks in government know that every time they create a secret or if they make a decision to classify a document, they're spending $460 of your taxpayer dollars every single time they do that.
They need better to know be able that to explain why.
If they withhold a document, that there might be consequences for improperly hiding information.
All right, Rick, let's talk about the FISA court a little bit here. Now, you say in your report that only four times in the history of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court have they denied the FBI's request to tap phones or such like that. Now, I only know of two times that the FISA court has denied warrants, and that's John Wong and Zacharias Moussaoui. Who am I missing?
Well, there's two other cases, and we haven't been able to figure out what the other two cases are. But they were also around the same time as those. This was in around 2002. Other than those four cases, the government has a perfect record. They're batting 1,000 in going to the secret court and asking for an order for them to go conduct surveillance on a foreign national on U.S. soil.
Okay, now that's the importance of the FISA court, right? There's a lower standard of evidence for foreigners.
There's a much lower standard for getting an order to conduct surveillance than through the traditional, what we think of as the traditional law enforcement activity and going and getting a subpoena. And that's part of the problem here is what through the traditional law enforcement system, we get a lot of reporting about how these court orders are used, how search warrants are used. So we can, members of the public can go through that and figure out whether the government's abusing those powers. Well, in the FISA court, all we get is what we put in our report. Every year you find out how many FISA secret court orders or secret orders were made. And in 2004, there were, I think it was 1,700. I think that's the number that we have in our report. And that's almost a doubling in the last 4 years in the amount of activity that has run through this secret court. And part of the reason that the government is batting nearly 1,000 on their request is that there's no flip side. There's no defendant. In traditional courts, you have the government and then you have the other side. And they both go to the judge and say, okay, here's our case. And then the judge decides. And all you have is the government going to the court, this secret court. And so it's no wonder that they're batting 1,000 because there's no opposition.
That's really interesting that they've gotten 1,700 warrants and yet not a single conviction of any terrorists, except for those guys in Detroit that they had to let go because it turned out the FBI had perjured themselves on the stand in order to get the conviction.
Well, and that leads to the broader question when you look at all these numbers. The broader question is the government being effective? Is it being effective in making sure that the public has enough information so that we can protect our families and protect our kids? We can look at crime statistics in our communities and help the police do a better job of making our communities safer. Can we make informed choices if there were an accident or something happened in our neighborhood and we had to get out and evacuate? Do we have enough information as citizens, as the public, to be able to make our own choices? I mean, that's the essence of our democracy. You know, let the government do what it's going to do, but let me live so that I can be safe and I can be free. And the question, the answer, unfortunately, is we really don't have enough information. I don't know the right evacuation route to get out of my community. I live near downtown Washington, D.C. I live just outside the District of Columbia in Maryland. And I'm not sure where, you know, where the chemical plants are around my neighborhood so that I can plot where I should be going, what's the safest route. And that's information that I really should have and that I should have a right to, and that should be at my fingertips. The government doesn't do a good job of giving you enough information so that we can be ready when something happens or if something happens.
All right. There is a premise there somewhere back in American history that it's better to just go ahead and have an open society, and that, yes, hey, there are drawbacks. You know, the terrorists might be able to easily find a map to a nuclear plant. But on the other hand, you'll be able to find your map away from it. And in the end, the belief, I think, used to be that it's worth it to just go ahead and have an open society, even with all the drawbacks that come with it.
The benefits of an open society far outweigh the drawbacks. And that was a fundamental clash that we had in the Cold War with the old Soviet Union. The Soviet Union thought it was okay to redraw the maps so that towns would look like they appear on the east side of a river when they actually were on the west side of the river, when they did not have a strong sort of social science where they didn't take much of a census and the numbers weren't accurate. Well, you know, we believe in having accurate numbers. We believe in understanding ourselves so that we can identify problems or we can debate problems openly and decide whether these are things that we need to be taking action on. You know, that's the wonderful thing about freedom, is that we can sit around the table and we can debate these issues and debate racism in America or debate whether we have a strong enough military. And we have, you know, reality, we have truth that we can look at. And so that helps us make informed decisions. And then we have a representative government so that we can go to our members of Congress and our leaders and say, look, here's the facts. You're not doing a good enough job here or there, or you know, you need to do more on Social Security or less on Social Security. You need to protect my gun rights. You don't need to protect my gun rights. Whatever it is, we can communicate openly with our elected representatives and call them back home if they're doing a bad job. That's the essence of our democracy, and we have to be informed, and we have to keep tabs on government, and we have to make sure that they are giving us enough information so that we can hold them accountable.
But don't you know it's wartime? Everything changed on September 11th.
Well, I haven't seen a war declaration. I know that there are people out there who would love to kill as many Americans as they could. I also know that, you know, there's a number of scientists and researchers and people working on technology who would love to do as much as they can to advance our society and to keep it running and to bring us new innovations. And, you know, I'm sitting here with a cell phone that's, you know, probably 10 times smaller than what a cell phone was 10 years ago. You know, I want these things. I want these people to be finding new scientific solutions so that I can protect my kids and so that we have new vaccines and so that we have new drugs. And that requires openness. It requires a very strong education system. It requires building on each other's advances so that the government doesn't step in to a scientific publication and say, look, don't publish this. If you publish this, then someone might get some ideas. And they might be armed with information to do us harm. And that's actually happened. We had earlier this year, we had the government step in and write a letter to a very prestigious academic journal, a scientific journal called the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and say, look, if you publish this paper that you're planning to publish, which dealt with the potential and the vulnerabilities in our milk supply and our food supply, from bioterrorism. The government said, if you publish this, you're going to do great harm to national security because you're going to give more information than a terrorist could use to do us harm. Well, the journal looked at it, and they decided we need to publish because the benefits of getting this information, getting this analysis and this perspective to the public and to other scientists far outweighs the potential damage. Now, there's been a great debate about this author's study and about whether they're overblowing the problems and the threat to the milk supply or whether they're right on target. There's been a great public debate about that, and that's what we should be doing. We should be debating these issues.
Yeah, they got lucky, I guess, that it wasn't the government's call in the end. It was just a request not to publish.
It was a request, and the law does not give the government the authority yet to order the pre-publication censorship of scientific journals. And we need to be clear that we do need to have the free flow of information, free flow of scientific research, and every time you add a new designation of controlling unclassified information, and every time you overclassify documents, you're inhibiting our ability to do that good research and to get that knowledge into the public domain where we can actually use it and find it useful and apply it.
Sure, and, you know, back to, I think, where we started, and the most important point here is accountability. It's not just our ability to trade information freely among each other, but it's information about what our government is up to and whether or not we have the ability to call them on it. And, of course, we can't if we don't know what it is they're up to. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with Rick Bloom. He's the director of OpenTheGovernment.org, which just produced their second secrecy report card, Quantitative Indicators of Secrecy in the Federal Government. And we'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. We're wrapping up with Rick Bloom, director of OpenTheGovernment.org. And they've just produced their second annual secrecy report card, Quantitative Indicators of Secrecy in the Federal Government. And in this last segment, sir, I got two topics I want to get to real quick. The federal advisory meetings. I want to know exactly what that is, if that's like the Dick Cheney Energy Task Force or what kind of thing there. And then we need to talk real quickly about Sybil Edmonds as well. So your report card here talks about federal advisory meetings and how they're being classified. What exactly are those?
Well, all across the government and executive branch agencies, whether it's the Food and Drug Administration or the Environmental Protection Agency, any federal agency that seeks technical advice or scientific advice on an ongoing basis will have an advisory committee. These are folks mostly outside of government that they seek advice from. And it's, you know, usually technical stuff, or it might be controversial environmental protection and regulations, and so they get people to give them advice. Well, when we looked at it, when the law was passed in the mid-70s, the idea was that these meetings should be open and they should be free from influence of any special interest and that they should be balanced and that public should be able to see and there should be public notices, all this good stuff. Basically, they should be open and available to the public. Well, what we've seen is that over the past few years, these meetings are more and more closed to the public. And when we looked at the number of meetings that were held that were completely closed, we found that an astonishing 64% of these meetings were closed to the public.
Wow, 64%.
Almost two-thirds of these meetings were completely closed to the public. On top of that, you had other meetings that were partially closed. So they might have been going into executive session, or they might have been dealing with some topic that they thought was especially sensitive, and so they closed part of the meeting.
So do Cheney's Energy Task Force meetings count as part of this? Or that was
the whole issue of the lawsuit, was does it count under this law, under this thing called the Federal Advisory Committee Act? And what the courts decided was that it did not, because technically the Cheney Energy Task Force committee was actually established only of folks who were inside government. Now, they got a lot of advice from people outside government, not too many environmental organizations, but a lot of organizations that were outside government. And the issue was, should this be considered a committee that should fall under the openness requirements of the law? And the courts decided that it did not, because there were no people. There was nobody who was voting on this committee that was outside government. Now, they kept meeting and they kept getting ongoing advice. And so it really, I think the court decision really was a blow to the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And it opens the door to more kinds of meetings that would fall outside the openness laws. But even among the meetings that fell within the Federal Advisory Committee Act, nearly two-thirds of them were completely closed. Now, a lot of these were scientific meetings of the National Science Foundation, or they might have been grant review committee meetings. And so there's understandably some of these meetings will be closed. But over time, we've seen a steady increase in the proportion of advisory committee meetings that are completely closed. And even when you take out these kinds of scientific grant kind of meetings or in committee meetings, the number of closed meetings goes way up.
Okay, now, very quickly, everybody who listens to this show is familiar with Sybil Edmonds and the state secrets privilege that's been used against her. But you say in your report it's been used a lot more than just against Sybil Edmonds.
There are a lot of cases where the state secrets privilege has been used, and it's been used against Sybil, and our case is still ongoing, and it's still closed, and we're going to try and help her out as much as we can. And it's very hard to get a complete read on the number of times that it's been used, but we do know that there have been, in one case alone, and we didn't say this in the report, but in one case in the last year, the administration talked about using the state secrets privilege dozens and dozens of times.
Wow. All right, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it right there. Everybody, Rick Bloom, he's from OpenTheGovernment.org. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you very much.